And welcome again to the Dave Llewellyn Podcast. We cover sports stories, news, and newsmakers, and difference makers in our community and across the state. And I'm thrilled today to have Tom Wilson with us. He had 4 decades of involvement and executive leadership in sports and entertainment in Detroit and across the state of Michigan with his involvement with the Pistons, the Palace of Auburn Hills, Little Caesars Arena in Detroit, the Illich organization. It is a thrill, my pleasure, to have Tom Wilson join us today on the Dave Llewellyn Podcast. Welcome. Thank you for this.
Happy to be here. It's good to see you.
And we're all about the stories, so we want to hear stories of your 4 decades as a sports and entertainment executive. But I want to start with the date of June 12th, 1989. Important because the night before, the Pistons had beaten the Los Angeles Lakers to go up 3-0 in the NBA Finals. The night before, the team would clinch its first ever and win the first ever NBA championship. Reflect back on that. The night before you win the first NBA championship, what were you, your team, administrators, if you will, with the Palace and the Pistons, thinking, what was that moment like on the verge of winning a championship?
Well, you know, it was, Dave, it was still surreal. I mean, we had, many of us had been there for 8 to 10 years, you know, so in the first 5 of those years, we were just god awful. And then Isaiah came along, Kelly came along, and suddenly we had something, Kelly Chipuka.
Yeah.
Suddenly we had a team that was worth watching, but you kind of never thought we'd ever make it to this point. And the year before we were there, we had a bad call, we would say, in game 6.
The Phantom Lambeer call.
Yes, and you thought, you know.
And then Isaiah's ankle, too.
Yes, and so you knew you had to win that game, and you had the Phantom call, and then you figure, well, we got no chance in 7, and so what, more than anything, it wasn't the anticipation of winning. It's like, oh gosh, what's going to go wrong here? What bad can happen? What, you know? And you know, so I think it was more trepidation than anything else. I mean, you're pacing, you're worried. We're all worried, and very little talk about what are we going to do when we win. More like, oh my God, they're going to break our hearts again. Somehow we're gonna fail.
Yeah, and as in the people in the front office, you're not on the court. You can't change anything that's happening on the court itself. In that moment, you just have to wait and see how it plays out and what the result is.
Well, that's exactly right, and we should have won. I mean, Magic was down.
Yeah.
He'd pulled a hamstring. Byron Scott, the other starting guard, was out. He, I think, had also tweaked a knee or pulled a hamstring or something like that. So we've got the numbers. We're a better team. We're healthy. We're driven madly by Isaiah and the other guys. And so it all seemed like it should work. It's just the fear, because it's the biggest thing in your life. You know, when you get into sports, I think most everybody would say, you just want to win one time. One time you want to be the best at what you do, or recognized as the best at what you do. And so that's really your driver. And it's right there. It's right there. 24 hours from now, we can be the happiest people in the world, or we can reload for game 5, and it'll be a crushing downer. So I think nerves were probably the most important thing right now.
So it happened. You won game 4. You swept the Lakers. You win the NBA championship. This was out in L.A.
Yes, it was.
You win that first championship, and there's the celebration and the parade that follows and all that. You're on top of the mountaintop. And, you know, you were there when you were far from the mountaintop. And so to see that build and to have that leadership role in going from worst, you know, to champion – how rewarding was that?
It was the greatest feeling. And, you know, as I mentioned, you only want to win once until you win once. And then you only want to win twice. And so what the guys still talk about to this day is, you know, well, first of all, the night that we won, my wife and I slept with a trophy. So we had it like right between us. Nobody's getting this thing. You know, we're just gonna, Larry O'Brien's trophy was right there in bed in L.A.
In of itself.
Yeah. So we hopped on the plane. And we're flying back to Detroit, and I got everybody together, you know, back in the, somewhere in the middle of the plane, and I said, okay, let's start thinking about how do we take advantage of this, okay, because we just won this thing. Let's get – who's going to go out and start extending suites? What are we going to do on our sponsors? How are we communicating to our season ticket holders? Because we have a chance here to sort of add a couple years' length from a business standpoint to our lives. And everybody's going, well – I mean, we just won the championship.
Yeah, can't we enjoy this?
Can't we enjoy this for a minute, just a minute? And that was kind of the, I think the secret to all of our successes is that nobody ever relaxed. And we never sort of took a pause and said, you know, let's just kick back. Let's enjoy it. Maybe you did at the party or something like that. But the next day, it's like it's a moment in time. It's almost like Michigan winning the championship this year. You know, if you want to sell sponsorships or you want to do something for next year, do it now, because you don't know what's going to happen. Jim Harbaugh may leave. What if he does? And he does. And things just change. And suddenly a little bit of air leaks out of your balloon and everything like that. So that's what I remember. And then when we had the parade was just magical. And I remember my 1-year-old daughter being held for the entirety of the parade by Dennis Rodman. So now I wonder, was that the smartest move, you know?
Well, what a moment for sure. So you win in 89, the NBA expansion draft. You lose Rick Mahorn in the expansion draft, but come back, win again, back-to-back NBA champions in 90. Won that one in Portland with a win over the Trailblazers. Life was good. Life is even better. You got the second title.
Yeah, and it was tough. The Rick thing, you know, when you talk about things taking the wind out of your sails, you know, I mean, that was the day of the parade, and we find out that he's going to be gone in the expansion draft. And I remember the first game we played, first preseason game we played was against Philly, and that Ricky ended up in Philly with a trade. And he'd been calling Lambeer, like, all summer, because they were inseparable. Mm. They were, as you remember, best friends. Yeah. And Bill never returned his call. So finally at the game, you know, Rick runs over to him and said, Bill, geez, I've been calling you all summer. You know, you never returned my call. He says, well, you're not on my team. And it's a short story that's a window into Bill Lambeer.
Yeah.
You know, you're with us or you're against us. There's no middle ground. There's no, I used to be with you. You're not with us. And it was the thing that always drove Bill. And Bill was, in his own way, the conscience of the team. You know, he and Isaiah together were the ones who, as you brought players in, would sit them down or take them to dinner and say, you know, you're not in Kansas anymore. I mean, here's how we play. Here's how we approach each game and every game. And with that team and the 89-90 team, nobody got hurt. Yeah. You know, I mean, you can be hurt, but you're playing.
Yeah.
You're playing. Get off that training table. Yeah. Get out there. So we were, you know, when you won the second one, we had lost to Portland like 17 times in a row out in Portland, like literally 17, 18 times in a row. And so we were tied 1-1 going out there. And I think most of us are thinking, cripes, you know, we haven't beat these guys like in 9 years.
And wasn't it 2-3-2 then?
It was 2-3-2. Yeah. So we may never come back.
Yeah.
And then we win game three, we win game four, and you're going, oh my God, you know, and then of course Vinny hits it with 007 on the clock like that. And you do win it again. And you know, it's a dangerous thing. When you're really good, you think we're always going to be good. When you're really bad, you think we're always going to be bad. I mean, you can't see the light at the end of any tunnel, and you can't see the end of something that's happening. But, you know, guys age.
Yep.
And somewhere in there, the drive to get the second one was really, I think, as much Isaiah as anybody else. We didn't get enough credit for the first one. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like a fluke in people's minds. If we get a second one, they can't take that away from us. Ultimately, I think the feeling is we never got the credit that we probably should have had.
And you could argue you should have had three in a row.
Oh, we were close on that. And the year before that, it was the Bird interception inbounds pass where we would have beaten them in game six and come home to maybe win the whole thing.
Yeah.
Or game five, whatever it was. But anyway, it was crushing. You're crushing. And that's the thing that also the reason you appreciate those titles is how hard it was to get there.
Yeah.
You know, you got to get past Philadelphia with Dr. J. Then you got to get past Bird. Then you got to get past LA. And then ultimately, you know, you had to get past Michael when Michael became the story.
Yeah.
And when you do that, the feeling of satisfaction, I mean, it's great for us in the front office, but you can imagine what it's like for a player.
Yeah.
And the player to finally get, hopefully, the credit that he really deserves. And you look at Isaiah, he always makes the point that I beat Bird and I beat Magic. And I beat Michael.
Yeah.
Nobody else can say that, but he beat them all.
Yeah, he did. He sure did. We're going to talk more about Isaiah, more about your career, certainly. But Tom Wilson, former CEO, president of the Pistons and the Palace, Little Caesars Arena, Olympia Entertainment as well, during his incredible 40-plus year career in sports and entertainment in Detroit. But talking about Isaiah, let's talk about a couple of the key figures on that team in that era, starting with Isaiah, who really became the face of the franchise and the driving force, as you say, on the court, demanding of others and really leading the charge to championships. He was supremely talented, smart, but a complex individual as well.
Yeah.
His impact on this franchise and this city goes without saying.
You know, I saw Isaiah at Earl Cureton's funeral a month or so ago, and we had a chance to catch up. And I said, you know, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but whatever success I've had in my career, you know, I owe it all to you. I mean, without you, there is no Palace. And there is no Piston success, or it would have come later, or it would have come differently, or it never would have come. I mean, who knows? But everything good that's happened to me in my life somehow started with him coming to the city. And I said, I just, before I go, I just want you to know how much I appreciate that. But
how did he respond to that?
You know, he said, and Isaiah always says the right thing, but he says, you know, I think we did it as a team. You know, I think you did your part, I did my part, and together we worked miracles. And, you know, it was unnecessary to say that, but it was the right thing to say, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember we're probably five games into his career. So he's 19 years old, right? And we're stinking up the joint in like game five or game six. We'd won our first two games that he played against Milwaukee and Chicago. And then we went into a swoon. And he gets the team together at halftime and reads them the riot act. I didn't come out of school for this bull, you know, and just killed them. And we've got a lot of veterans in the locker room and stuff like that who are kind of astounded that this kid is coming in and chewing my ass, you know.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, that's what he did. And I think it was Kelser that was telling me about it, that like everybody stood up and said, well, okay. But then in that moment, it became his team.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always going to be his team. You know, even if he would, if other guys came along, and like a Joe Dumars became a terrific player, and we had a Dantley who was a terrific player, and Aguirre did his part, and a lot of guys, Rodman became, transcendent, actually, when he was here. It was always Isaiah's team, and he was always the conscience, and he was always the driver. I mean, mm-hmm. he would be on everybody, and he was always thinking, you know, how player additions or player subtractions or chemistry or whatever. And he spent a lot of time. He saved Chuck's job one year when Chuck was on the firing line, and Isaiah went to Mr. D and said, you know, we can win with this guy. You know, don't overreact. We're gonna be okay. And that was the year before we won the first championship. So he was instrumental in everything, but a very, very driven individual.
And his co-conspirator Lambeer in that, I mean, they were kind of tied at the hip for a lot of years, and especially during this championship run.
They really were. And Bill, Bill was a guy that, you know, he wasn't the most, obviously, the most athletic guy that you're going to find, not a great leap or anything like that, but he's so smart.
Yeah.
And both he and Isaiah really knew the game, and they knew the tricks. And sometimes you'd see Bill do something where he'd steal a jump ball or something like that because he'd move just a little bit quicker sooner than you're supposed to and stuff like that. And you'd talk to him after the game, he'd never acknowledge it. He'd just have a twinkle, like you caught me or you saw that or okay. But both of them were intensely competitive. I mean, not to a fault. I mean, they were intensely competitive when you needed them to be. You know, a Bill and Isaiah would show up every game. And it's hard. 80 games and playoffs and stuff, and year after year with long runs into the playoffs. I mean, it's exhausting physically. It's exhausting mentally. You've covered teams and been on the road with them. And, I did the broadcast for about 7 years. Mm-hmm. And we go out on a West Coast trip, and I'm doing the broadcast for like 3 or 4 games
in a row. And you're exhausted.
I'm exhausted. Yeah. And I'm doing nothing. but you see these guys in there, somehow they find it. Yeah. They'll be on the bus, and they're we shouldn't even call the game, come for the game tomorrow. And then the whistle blows, and there they are running through walls and stuff like that. It's a tough thing, but you needed guys like Lambeer and Isaiah to make the other guys get the other guys to play, or somebody like Jack McCloskey, our general manager, did a great job in character study, because you bring somebody in like Rodman, who had a love him, hate him, whatever you think about whatever he became, he had a motor like nobody I've ever seen, ever played harder than Dennis Rodman did. Yeah. And
could do so many unique things at his size, playing against bigger players.
Yeah.
I mean, he was incredible defensive force and rebounder.
And the funny thing is, he became the most popular player on that team. If you were to ask fans, because he was electric in his own way. And here's a guy. I remember talking once, and thought, he was starting to drift a little bit and everything. It was like, well, okay, I averaged 4 points a game last year, and I'm making $6.5 million. Tell me what I'm doing wrong. Yeah. All right. You make a good point. But he was invaluable to us. The last year that he played with us, I'm going to be wrong about this, but we go like 3-38 when he doesn't play. And when he plays, we're like 37-4 or something like that. I mean, it was amazing for a guy that averages nothing and just rebounds and plays defense, but he embarrassed you. Lambeer used to say he embarrasses you into playing harder, and you need guys like that, because he's going 100 miles an hour. He's like, I got to get going
here. I got to try to keep up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so we could go run down the entire roster, but let's mention Dumars too, because of his outsized role, both as a playing member of the Pistons, and then his work as GM and president of basketball operations. Also had in the 2004 championship season, he had a huge imprint on this franchise throughout his entire time here in Detroit.
He really did, and it was an interesting. I'll tell you one interesting story. I think because Bill Davidson got involved very rarely. He wanted his GM to make GM decisions and his coaches to make coaching decisions and everything like that. Every once in a while, he'd make an observation, and it was probably wise to listen to that observation. You didn't have to do it, but get his 2 cents. But anyway, Jack McCloskey was very close to trading Joe for a guy named Herb Williams, who was a 6'11 forward out of Ohio State and played at Indiana. Good player, probably an 18.9, 10 rebound guy. But you always trade little for big in those days. You always trade little for big if you could. So Jack's got that deal ready to go. And Mr. Davidson called him, and he said, I don't want to do the deal. I mean, you don't want to do the deal. I mean, this is the kind of deal that puts us in position to win the whole thing. You got Herb Williams, got Lambeer, you got Dantley or Aguirre here. I mean, we can beat anybody. He said, no, because you're never going to find a guard as good as Joe that will play second fiddle to Isaiah. Because if you're that good, you want to be the guy. Yeah. You want the accolades. You want the recognition. And you don't want to be the other guard. And Joe was content to take that role, to play the toughest guy on the defensive end, to hit the big shots when he was needed, but not to be the guy. Yeah. And so as a leader, and Joe was a leader, to say take the second or third or fourth chair on this team. And as it turned out, Mr. D was right. Mm-hmm. And Joe went on to really do a terrific job. When he took the GM position with the team, he made, if you look at that, the team that we had in 2004, we drafted Tayshaun Prince. Everybody else was a result of a trade or free agency or something like that, and it was put together piece by piece, and then finally we got Rasheed in a trade possibility. And Rashid was, you know, a little wacky
in
people's opinions.
But the final piece.
Final piece, and a really smart basketball player and a really talented basketball player who could play today because of his ability to shoot threes and everything
ball don't
like
lie.
That. Yeah, ball don't lie. he might have occasionally, but he was the last piece. And and then you go in, you win in 2004, which was impossible. We're playing a Laker team with Shaq and Kobe, Karl Malone, Gary Payton, four Hall of Famers. And so I go out there. We got no chance, right? We got no chance to win. It was an interesting time because we also owned the Tampa Bay Lightning. So we're in the conference final, or we're in the Stanley Cup finals with Tampa, and we're playing the Lakers in the finals also. So the quick story is we fly from Detroit out there, play the Lakers. We beat them in game one. Holy cow, that means the series is going to go five. You know, it doesn't mean we're going to win. It just means, hey, we're going to get an extra game. We go to the hotel. We get back in the plane, fly to Tampa. We win game seven. We win the Stanley Cup. We get down on the ice. You hold the trophy and everything. You get back in the plane, fly back to L.A., play game two. We lose it in overtime. Kobe hits a three to tie the game, and we lose it in overtime.
And I was there. And then you come home. And again, it was the two on the road, three at home scenario.
Yeah,
so you're 1-1 coming home.
Yeah.
You win all three, you're NBA champions. But who's going to do that against that Laker team,
well,
right?
Nobody. So I'm after game two. I mean, I'm like fuming because we're up three, and I'm one of those guys that likes to foul in that situation. You're up three with like 8 seconds to go or something like that. Just foul somebody. Yeah. Foul anybody. Yeah. But, you know, foul and make them go to the line. Some coaches don't want to do that. I think Larry Brown, who was our coach, did ask somebody to foul somebody, and they were late getting there. And so Kobe ends up hitting the shot. So I think, okay, well, there's a series. I mean, Christ, we could have been up 2-0. We could have won this thing. So I'm on the loading dock, and I'm pacing back and forth. And Magic comes over. He says, Tom, what are you upset about? I said, well, we had this thing. We had this thing. He says, you're going to win the series. He says, I'm telling you, you're going to win the series. He says, Shaq and Kobe are fighting. I mean, you watch them. Shaq makes a basket, Kobe's shooting next time down. Kobe makes a basket, Shaq's shooting the next time down. You guys are playing team ball. You're going to beat us. I'm telling you. Relax. I mean, and he's with the Lakers. With the Lakers. And, well, that's a good story. You know, so even if he's wrong, it's a story I'll tell the rest of my life, you know. But and sure as heck, there was a game where I don't think Kobe took a shot in the whole it might have been the first half, might have been the second half. I don't remember. But I think he took four or five shots in a game or something like that because there was an issue somewhere.
Yeah.
And very un-Kobe-like, very un-Shaq-like. But, you know, we won, and it was a series that it never occurred to me that we might win that thing going into it.
Yeah,
but what a good group of people Joe had put together.
Yeah, he sure did. Yeah. All right, so – that's three championships with the Pistons. Fantastic. Let's go back to the beginning now. You were up in Detroit, Cass Tech, Wayne State, went out to L.A. To pursue an acting career.
Yeah.
You did some of that, then moved into the sports area, worked, the Lakers, Kings, the Forum in marketing.
Yeah.
Then eventually came home, and Bill Davidson hired you. Or the Pistons hired you.
Right.
But very early on, I mean, you moved up, right? And at 28, as you mentioned, suddenly you're running the Pistons. We had lunch and you told the story of that and what he was paying you to run an NBA franchise at the age of 28. Would you share that?
Yeah, sure. I was when I was hired, I was hired as the head of sales. For $14,000, and then when I took over the organization, I was bumped all the way up to 16. It was a different time.
An NBA team making $16,000.
Should have been double that. Well, should have been double. Should have held out for. Should have held out for more.
you were going to pass up that opportunity.
Well, you know,
I mean, Who gets that opportunity?
Well, that's exactly right. You don't. And this, you have to remember, this was the rinkiest of rinky-dink franchises. I mean, when I went in, and they were still at Cobo Hall, the last year at Cobo Hall, I was the seventh employee, you know, I mean, which was great because if somebody calls in sick, I'm the sixth employee, you know, and so you can just, if there's anything that goes wrong, you know, I'm going to be moving up.
Yeah.
But the next year, we probably tripled our staff. We moved out to the Silverdome. But you still got 18 people. So it wasn't like I was the most talented guy. I was maybe the best of a bad lot. And, you know, but
hey, opportunity knocks.
Opportunity knocks. And the thing about Mr. D, one of the many amazing qualities of him, because I saw him do it with a lot of other people, not me, but a lot of other people, he can see what you can be, not what you are. He's able to look at your potential and, you know, if he likes how you think and he likes what you do and you've had, you know, and you're committed, you know, then he will take a chance on you. And so, you know, at 28, I was the only one in the organization now that had experience with a real team, having been with the Lakers for a couple of years. So, excuse me, I did have that going for me. But then you find as you have success, the level of trust is enormous. And, you know, for the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years I was there, you know, he never second-guessed me the entire time I was there. And I'm not saying he didn't go home and tell his wife what that moron did today. but to me, he never did. You know, every once in a while, if I'd tell him what I was doing, there might be some silence on the phone, but he would never follow it up with, you know, do you think you might want to, you know, look at that again? You know, he never did that. Yeah. And I'm sure in retrospect, I was wrong an awful lot, but he let me learn through being wrong, and that's the best way to do it.
Well, trust there, and then in turn, tremendous loyalty on your part to him. Right? Appreciation and gratitude. And you never left him.
No. Well, you know, I never had a father. My dad left when I was a year old. And so, you know, I grew up single parent and only child and stuff like that. And so he was almost like a father figure. Or maybe he even was. He's the closest, probably older male figure that was ever in my life. And we talked every day for, you know, 30 years. And so, you know, you learn about each other, you know, accidentally or through osmosis or something like that. But we'd vacation together and everything like that. So, you had a wide berth. And then the other thing is, fortunately, we were surrounded by great people in our organization, great front office. And so we had success upon success upon success. So whether it was the Palace being, you know, bigger and better than anybody ever dreamed, or Pine Knob, you know, just hitting it out of the ballpark for, you know, 19 years in a row, we were the number one franchise or number one amphitheater in the country. That's in Detroit, Michigan. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty impossible. And the Palace setting a standard for all arenas and setting off the biggest building boom in the NBA and in the in America ever. And that was a building where people criticized Bill Davidson and said it was Davidson's folly and it'll never work. And, you know, I remember we used to have this Cranes publication, and Cranes came out with an editorial on what a stupid idea it was. And so we had framed the article along with their suite lease, you know, when they came aboard. And we always thought, well, that's a fun thing. So we gave that to him because, but I think that was one reason that we never sold the name to the Palace is I think he took great pride in the fact that everybody told him, his friends and publications and media all said what a bad idea it was, and then it turned out to be a game changer. Yeah. And I think he was always very, very, very proud of that.
Well, and it was his money that built it. I mean,
yes,
you know, he didn't ask for money from, you know, local or regional municipalities or entities, you know, to fund this, or taxpayers. I mean, he built it.
Yeah, and that was him. I mean, because he didn't want to answer to anybody. You know, he took Guardian Industries, his company, private. You know, he had gone public and made a lot of money on it, and then he gathered up all the other money because I don't want to be responsible to shareholders. I don't want to be responsible to the, you know, SEC or anybody else. Right. And so if I got a problem, I just want to fix it. And that's how he felt about the arena. If I got a problem here, I don't want to go in front of the board at Auburn Hills or do this or do that or go to the state or go to the county or anything like that. I just want to fix it.
Yeah.
And so, but I mean, it was daring. The most expensive building ever was like $20 million, I think, maybe in Landover for the Wizards and the Capitals. And so we had a budget of maybe 40. And Bill said at the time, he said, look, I'm going to give you this money because he said, I'm not running this. I'm not building this thing. I don't know anything about arenas. You're going to do it. I said, well, I don't know anything about arenas. He says, well, you'll figure it out. What are you going to do? Have the seats facing the wrong way? I mean, you know, you got a problem, fix it. And, yeah. You know, you learn. And he knew, as he sort of threw me to the wolves, but he knew that coming out of this experiment, right. You're going to have a better executive because I will have had to answer all these questions along the way. I will have had to solve problems on my own along the way.
Well, it was innovative, no doubt, with the, you know, the lower level suites, the number of suites, in total, and the revenue that you were able to generate, especially with a successful basketball team and the concerts and everything else through that new building, I mean, it was a home run times however many you want to attach to it, right?
Well, that's right. And what you found, these buildings were always municipal buildings. They were built by cities or states or counties or something like that because they were always going to lose money. And maybe this year we lost $1 million, maybe we lost three. We got to go back to whoever that source is. And Bill just said, look, I'm going to put in the 40, which turned out to be 80, which was a lot of money back then, and particularly on a folly. And he said, but when this is done, you got to design it in a way where it's going to pay for itself because the bank is closed. I mean, don't come to me and say, well, you know, I guess we missed it by a couple million. He said, there's no more money. This is it. So that led to the design of the suites because we had to come up with some sort of revenue source. And so we did put them where they'd never been before. And we got lucky. We had a developer who'd never developed one, a builder who'd never built one, an architect who'd never designed one. And that sounds like a recipe for failure and me going to run it, and I don't know what I'm doing. And yet, when we went to the architect who'd never built a building or designed a building and said, we want to put the things down here on the lower level, 14, 15, 16 rows off the floor, a real architect who'd done a million of these would have said, it can't be done. It'll ruin your sight lines. These guys said, it can't be done. It'll ruin your sight lines. And I drew it on a napkin. I said, what if we make like almost like a bunker? We put all the entertaining back here under the stands. Then you won't necessarily, I don't think it'll work, but we'll work on it. And again, somebody who'd done a million of these things would have just thrown it in the trash. They went back and they came back a week later and said, you know, if you want to do this, I think we can do it. It'll cost you a few seats down a few rows of seats. But
you're selling those others at a premium, level that's going to more than make up for that.
So David Stern, who was the commissioner at the time, I remember we were at a Board of Governors meeting. So all the owners were there. And he says, gentlemen, you got one job this year. Okay, you got to get to Auburn Hills and you got to see that building. Because we're not in the basketball business anymore. We're in the arena business. We're in the entertainment business. We're in the development business. And we're in the basketball business. Yeah. But get there. And so Chicago came in, and they built a much bigger, much better palace. And then Phoenix broke ground, and then boom, boom, boom. And the dominoes all fell. And the buildings that were open simultaneous with ours, like Miami and Orlando, those were gone in 10 years. Yeah. And they'd had to replace them with something that looked more like ours.
Let's fast forward now to your time with the Illich organization and the development of Little Caesars Arena, which you had a large hand in as well. Your experience with the Palace. How did that play into what was developed with Little Caesars Arena and what we have today, which is, I mean, state of the art, right?
Yeah, it's a great arena. I think the difference in this one, you know, whereas in the Palace, Bill sort of said, you know, you figure it out, you do it, and everything like that. The Little Caesars Arena is really a credit to Chris Illich because, you know, it started out as maybe a $500 million arena, and it ended up, you know, close to $1 billion. I mean, somebody very passionate and very committed has to make those decisions every step of the way. And Chris was, I mean, he lived that thing, and he asked questions questions about every single element, design element and actual functional element and so forth. Everything, every sweet detail, I mean, you name it. And he was intimately involved. So whereas I could take a little bit of credit for the palace, you got to give him, if you love the building, you got to give him all the credit in the world for making it happen. Yeah. And, you know, maneuvering the minefield of trying to get funding for it and everything like that, because it's, you know, that's never easy.
Right, right. But you had to shepherd the process as well, though. I mean, that kind of fell on you.
Yeah. Well, we did a lot of traveling because everybody in that business, everybody steals from everybody. Everybody borrows from everybody else. And we borrowed a lot.
Yeah.
But you try and take advantage of all the knowledge is there. And then you supplement that with the fact that technology is changing so fast that nobody else has this, this, and this. So this is our chance because now it exists. It didn't exist 5 years ago. And so, you know, he really... you know, whether it's the lighting in the ceiling or whatever it might happen to be, you know, there were very few times if we took something to him and said, okay, it's this, but it's going to cost this. You know, if it was a good idea, he'd say, let's do it. Yeah. Let's go for it.
And, all right. So, let's talk about what had to be a very sad day for you, given that history, and that is watching the palace come down. I mean, Tom Gores buys the Pistons from Karen Davidson, Bill's wife, widow, and still a beautiful building. Millions had been put into it after it was originally constructed. You know, didn't look dated, was fully functional, could have continued for years and years to come, but the decision was made to move downtown, move the Pistons downtown under the new ownership. I guess didn't want competition with buildings, whatever. Right. But to see that building come down, that had to be a sad day.
It was hard because when you're in that business, and particularly, you know, I mean, if you go back, my mother-in-law found the property, you know, when we decided to build it, because everything was hush-hush. So she was a realtor, and so she went out and found the property. We flew in a helicopter over five or six sites that she identified and picked that one. My wife had done a lot of the decorating of the suites and the offices and things like that. My kids grew up there, you know, because you're at a million events, you know, you're at every family show, every conceivable, you know, major concert and stuff like that. So, you know, my son was a ball boy. My daughter was a ball boy for, you know, 5 years, my son for 10. Yeah. I mean, it's all we knew. I mean, this was our life, a big, big slice of our life. And I wasn't the only one. I mean, so many of our people, they just stayed. Yeah. They just stayed forever and ever and ever. And there was no... sort of migration out until I went downtown, and then probably 20 to 30 of the best people came with me, which was great. But that sort of eroded the palace, I think, a little bit, because you lose that kind of talent.
Sure.
But all of us had this proprietary interest. And the interesting thing, I think, quickly, is that we had a lot of these folks who had been with us at the Silverdome. And so when we built the palace, I think we sort of, as a culture, just sort of said, we want everybody's influence and input. So sponsorship guy, I'll work with you, but you figure out what we're going to do. Operations, I'll work with you, but, you know, you figure out what you. Yeah. So we had a proprietary interest on the part of so many different people. This is my building.
Yeah.
Well, it's my building. Well, it's my building. Yeah. And when everybody owns it and everybody feels that sense of pride, it's pretty impactful, I think.
Yeah. All right, so the palace is gone, and some could argue the Pistons are gone. I mean, in terms of a competitive NBA team right now, the record certainly reflects that. 14 wins this year? I mean, 17 the year before that, 20 the year before that. When you started, you know, the Pistons were at the bottom, and you rose to a championship team and franchise.
Mm-hmm.
This team's at the bottom again under this ownership, and I don't know when it's going to turn around.
Yeah, it's hard to say. The one thing I do know, Dave, from being in a business a long time, is that nobody knows anything. You know, I mean, when you're sitting outside as a fan or a media person or something like that, you know, you have a pretty good idea, you think, or you know. you think what's going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really don't. I mean, it's for that reason I quit listening to talk radio like a million years ago, because they would criticize us, and I'd be driving home, and I'd be fuming. Said, well, that's not even close to true.
Yeah.
But, you know, good opinions. You know, when you get away from it, you go, it's a good opinion, but not quite right. So when you say, what's wrong with the Pistons? What do they have to do? Where did they go wrong? And stuff like that. Sometimes it's buzzard's luck. You know, you end up with the worst record in the league last year, and the worst you can finish in the lottery is five, and you finish five. Yeah. And you'd spend all that time hoping for a Wembanyama you know, Scoot Henderson or somebody like that, and you don't. And you get a next, you know, a good talent in Oscar Thompson, but, you know, maybe not as good as as the other two guys who are maybe franchise players.
And they could be in that situation again this year, even with the worst record in the league because of lottery and whatnot.
Yeah. So, and not a great draft year. Not considered a great draft year. So it's going to be some time. The thing as I look at it, they've got four or five pieces that are pretty good. And I'm not sure what happened this year. Some people would say they needed more veterans in there to show the young guys, because you got your three key people are under 22 on that team. And, you know, I think somebody told me the other day, Michigan State started four guys older than the Piston starters, you know, a lot of games. Yeah. That's pretty interesting. And I think it's pretty true. And so, you know, sometimes they need veteran leadership, and sometimes it comes from the coach, but very often you need it to come in the locker room.
They've turned that roster over so many times already and seemingly don't have a clue. I mean, I'll say it. You don't have to, but I mean, I don't know where they go from here. And now they're talking about a, you know, president of basketball operations again to report to directly to Tom Gores, with the general manager serving under him. I mean, you know, is that the answer, or do they got to get rid of the guys that have been, you know, calling the shots for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, well,
because it hasn't worked.
Yeah, it's interesting. I sometimes look back, you know, as I look at this situation, you know, I look back to how did we piece it together back in you know, back in the 80s when Isaiah came in and you made a couple of great draft picks. I mean, Kelly Chipuka was not, you know, I mean, Kelly was like not a top 10 pick or anything like that. He was a bigger star in the city for a year or two than Isaiah was. Mm. I mean, he was charismatic also in his own way, and he was a better scorer than Isaiah was early on. And then changes happened and everything like that. He got hurt and so on. But, you know, when you think, as I mentioned earlier, when you're bad, you think we're going to be bad forever. And then something happens. And so when Doug Collins came in here, he made a couple of great trades, and we went from just god-awful to a playoff team to the next year. You know, he was the all-star coach because we had the best record. Yeah. We started off when we brought in Flip Saunders after we lost Larry Brown, you know, suddenly we go like 38-4 or 38-5 or something like that. Beat the 84 Tigers record, you know, and like, how is this happening? So you can piece it together. We lost Grant Hill, and we got stuck with Ben Wallace. And it turns out to be the transformational player, and he became the conscience of that team. Chauncey Billups, a free agent that, you know, had flamed out with four or five other teams. Rip Hamilton, we get for our best player, Jerry Stackhouse. People criticize that trade, but he was a great piece. So
he fit.
It's piece by piece, and it's patience, and it's trying to be right, you know, 80% of the time. And you got to do your homework, and maybe you don't take a lot of chances, or maybe you put yourself in a position where, you know, I got to get this piece, and we'll mortgage a little bit of the future.
And even given that, how bad it has been, you know, Tom Gores, who bought the team for what, $325 million, at least that's one figure I read, you know, the valuation of franchises has just exploded. And so the Pistons win 14 games, but if you believe the Forbes magazine valuations of franchises, they're worth over $3 billion.
It's amazing.
That's a hell of a return on investment, isn't it?
It is, and you know, it's a...
And without success.
Yeah, without success so far. So far.
So far.
But I'll tell you that what's going to be really interesting, and watch this, in a year, they're going to redo all the television deals, and I think you might see people like Amazon coming in, or you know, Apple or somebody else getting involved. But the feeling is, deep down, you'll have players making $80 to $100 million a year.
A year.
A year. Because they have this formula where the revenues are split 50-50. Hockey has the same basic formula. But the revenues in basketball, because basketball is becoming, a great product because it's on every night and, you can build networks around it and everything like that. And so it's going to be a different world. It's going to be a really, really different world.
And you stepped out of it.
And I stepped out of it, or they threw me out. I'm not sure which it was.
Do you miss it in retirement?
You know, I miss a lot of things. You know, when I left the Lakers, and it was kind of a bad situation. It was the only 2 years that the club didn't make the playoffs for ages and ages and ages. I traded for Kareem, I think, my second year, and that didn't work. You know, everybody around him got injured and everything like that. But we had a different owner. Jack Kent Cook was the owner, and people used to get fired there, like, all the time. Like, and the tension and the pressure was incredible. So when I left, it's like, thank God, this is I can breathe. Like 3 weeks later, I miss the winning. I even miss the losing. I miss the competitiveness that there is out there every night. When you had two teams, you're breaking your heart every other day to pick a sport. And I thought, God, someday I would love to get back into this. As much as I had a semi-miserable experience there, and then the Pistons gave you a chance. So what you find is as you step out of it, you do miss the highs and lows. You really miss the highs.
Yeah, yeah.
But you even miss the lows, and more than anything, you miss the people. And so that's the toughest part. Having said that, life is great. So, when I look back, I have nothing but wonderful feelings and feel like I've been incredibly blessed in my lifetime. I'm a guy from 6 Mile in Woodward, on the other side of the tracks, I mean, we had nothing and ended up having the ride of a lifetime. So I'm a very... happy person. Got a great family and a great wife, and it doesn't get any better than this.
And a great life.
And a great life.
I think it's a great place to leave it. Thank you for this. We could talk for another hour. Maybe we'll do that another time.
Anytime.
But this has been great. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming in and being part of this. Your career has been incredible. Your influence and impact on franchises and entertainment in this town, and it's a legacy that will live on. There's no question about that. Tom, thanks.
Thank you, David.
Tom Wilson joining us on the Dave Llewellyn podcast. A wonderful conversation. We've got more of that ahead for you in the weeks to come. You find us on YouTube, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, your favorite source for podcasts, and certainly appreciate you subscribing, sharing it with your friends, telling others about this content that we're bringing to you. We certainly enjoyed today. Thanks to our producer-director, Josh Bowron. And until next time, stay safe, be kind.